Hello, and welcome to Life's Little Mysteries with Live Science. I'm Gina Briner, Editor-in-Chief at Live Science.
And I'm Mindy Weisberger, a Senior Writer at Live Science.
Today, we're bringing you a special episode of Life's Little Mysteries. Usually, we keep things pretty light, but this time, we're going to focus on a serious topic that everybody is talking about, and that's the SARS coronavirus 2, the virus that causes the disease COVID-19.
At Life Science, our reporters and our editors are tracking the latest coronavirus developments around the world, from global case numbers and quarantines to vaccine development to best practices for safety, prevention, and treatment.
Here with the latest coronavirus news is Life Science health reporter Nicoletta Lanis. She's at the forefront of our coronavirus coverage.
This episode was recorded on April 9th and features Nicoletta's weekly coronavirus update and Q&A on Facebook Live. Link to the video is in the show notes.
Hello, and welcome to this week's coronavirus update with Live Science. My name is Nicoletta Lanis, and I am a health reporter here at the site. And I'm here to answer questions you have about COVID-19, about scientific developments from this past week, about social distancing, anything you can think of. If you do have questions throughout this live stream, please insert them in the comments below and we'll try to get to as many questions as possible. We usually run this live stream on Thursdays from about noon to 12:30. So again, a limited time frame. So we'll try to answer the most commonly asked questions. I'll start off by giving you a brief update on where we're at in terms of case numbers, and then give you an idea of what's happening in the scientific world, what's happening with case counts specifically in the US, but also just in terms of what we know about the virus and how it interacts with the body and how we might be able to treat the illness that it causes. So worldwide, we're now seeing that the total case count is over 1.5 million. Nearly 90,000 people have died from COVID-19 around the world. Over 340,000 people have recovered worldwide, according to current counts. But again, all these numbers are slightly skewed because diagnostic testing and antibody testing are not widespread to the point that we understand, number one, how many cases exist in general, how many cases have taken place in the past, and we haven't caught in normal rounds of diagnostic testing, etc. So the number of recovered might be much higher. The number of deaths is likely a more accurate measure just because these people present into the hospital. But for instance, here in New York, not everyone who's catching COVID-19 is necessarily making it to the hospital. So some people are dying at home. That has been confirmed. So even those death counts might be off. Within mainland China, they have now reported about 82,900 cases. That's only up from 82,400 as of last week. So that's a dramatic difference in the number of new cases being reported week to week. And they did, as of April 7th, lift the lockdown on Wuhan, the city where the outbreak was first spotted. So this city contains millions and millions of people, and it's been under lockdown for over 10 weeks now. They are suspecting, generally speaking, via models, since we do not have a vaccine for this virus yet, and we do not have an approved treatment, there is a chance that we'll see a second surge of cases, both in Wuhan and in China in general, especially now that these restrictions are being lifted. That said, it's been projected to not happen until later in the fall, given the lockdown measures they'd instituted for so long. But we'll just have to watch and see how that unfolds going forward. And especially given new understanding of the virus, perhaps some mitigation measures can remain in place and remain in the public consciousness. And people will just be more careful about practicing diligent hygiene, social distancing to a certain extent, etc. Within the United States, we're now seeing that there are over 432,000 cases reported. That's up from over 216,000 as of last week. So we're seeing the number grow and grow and grow every week. That's as diagnostic testing is ramping up throughout the country, although many, many states are under directives to stay at home. That meaning that if people are at home and start developing symptoms of COVID-19, unless they are more severe or have reason to suspect that they could develop severe complications. These people are probably not getting tested for the disease, except in special cases. So again, the case count is probably skewed. Within the U.S., we're seeing that there are over 14,800 deaths caused by the virus. And as of now, 24,200 recovered cases have been recorded. Again, this number seems low, but we don't know truly how many people have caught the disease. So presumably in the coming weeks, especially when an antibody test is more widely available, that number should better reflect what's actually happening here in the U.S. Antibody tests, to clarify, take a sample of a person's blood and scan it for antibodies, which are developed by the immune system in response to a new pathogen. And these antibodies latch on to the pathogen should you ever encounter it again and can direct the immune system to attack it and clear it from the body. So if these antibodies are circulating in a person's system and they're specific to COVID-19, that would suggest that they've already been exposed to and been infected by the virus. So just to give you some kind of rapid fire updates, I won't go into too much detail into these, but New York State has now reported more cases than any other country in the world aside from the US. So that means surpassing Italy, surpassing Spain, et cetera, et cetera, far surpassing China at this point. This week, we saw one day with the highest single day death toll reported in New York, with nearly 780 people dying in one day. In New Orleans, we have the highest COVID-19 death rate per capita in the U.S. as compared to other counties. So that's the two parishes that are being hit hardest in Louisiana are St. John the Baptist Parish and then the Orleans Parish. And again, per their population count in general, they have the highest death rate out of any counties in the U.S. And this is for a variety of reasons. If you check out our state's update pages on Live Science, you can get into more detail about what's happening in different states. So every single U.S. state has a page dedicated to headline news from today, case counts, and policies around what's going on with social distancing, etc. Abroad, we're seeing that the British Prime Minister is still in the ICU with a confirmed case of COVID-19, but apparently is improving, according to a spokesperson. He is on some sort of breathing assistance at this point in the ICU. We're seeing that New Zealand, after reporting their first case a number of months ago, having been very diligent about putting in place measures practiced by other countries as well, is really doing well at mitigating the spread of the virus and has not reported a large number of cases or deaths at this point, but has instituted very stringent measures to prevent that. So we're thinking the reports have been looking at New Zealand as an example of if measures are put in place early and very restrictively, there's a chance that you can stop an outbreak from running out of control before it even happens. Now, of course, New Zealand is kind of a very special case given its landmass and, you know, a limited number of people, although they do have a high number of tourists that come through, and the way they've handled that has been very impressive. So we have a story on livescience.com about how New Zealand has handled COVID-19 so far. We do have a new report up on the site as well about how COVID seems to affect the heart. So even in people who don't have some sort of previous medical condition that compromises the heart, they're seeing a lot of instances of either heart damage, organ failure, things like this. So there's a question of why that is happening. And there's a couple explanations that people are looking into now in more detail. So part of it is just that the lungs and the heart work in very close harmony with each other. The lungs are part of what brings oxygen into the body and brings it into the bloodstream, which again, the heart then circulates that blood and that oxygen throughout the body. So if the lungs are having to work harder or something is gumming up the works, like this virus can do, the heart has to work even harder than it usually does to circulate the limited amount of oxygen that it now has. So that's part of it, is that just physical strain that's placed on the heart when the lungs aren't doing as well. So that's one possibility. There's another possibility that the virus is actually attacking the heart directly. So the ACE2 receptor, which the virus uses to infect cells, it's like the doorway into the cell for the virus, don't just appear on respiratory cells, but appear in cells throughout the body and are actually better known for how they interact with the cardiovascular system, because they play a role in regulating blood pressure. And they also serve as a kind of anti-inflammatory. So these receptors react to cytokines, which are inflammatory molecules, when they're circulating in the body in response to some sort of immune upset. And they actually act to mitigate that damage that could be caused by cytokines when they're trying to attack some sort of pathogen, some sort of debris, something that's not supposed to be in the body, but end up hurting organs, etc. instead. So normally the ACE2 receptor serves those roles. But if the virus is interfacing with ACE2 receptors in the heart, there's a possibility that they can no longer serve that anti-inflammatory function, and immune activity going on in the body could damage the organ more so than it usually would. And obviously, if the virus is directly infecting heart cells, that's also causing damage in that way, directly by just through the process of viral replication that we see also in the respiratory tract. So it's important to work out how the SARS-CoV-2 virus interacts with the heart directly, because that will inform us in terms of how we want to treat patients that are showing these symptoms. So if the virus truly is attacking heart cells directly, that would mean that an antiviral would probably be the best course of treatment, at least the most aggressive course of treatment that you could give. Now, if the damage to the heart is more caused by an amplified immune response that is being somehow dampened by the infection, then an immunosuppressant might actually help patients recover more quickly. Now, if you give an immunosuppressant when you shouldn't give an immunosuppressant, that could leave the body open to more damage. So this is a really important question to work out. Wrapped up in all of this is how ARBs and ACE inhibitors relate to COVID-19 patients. So these are both medications that help to regulate high blood pressure by widening blood vessels. And it's unclear, because they interact with similar systems that are all related to the ACE2 receptor, although ACE inhibitors typically target the ACE1 receptor, which is related, but not the same. It's unclear whether these drugs might help patients or hurt patients who get infected with COVID-19. There's studies being done to address both questions, and in the coming weeks, we should have a better picture of what that landscape looks like. We've heard a lot about aerosols in this past week. Aerosols being very, very tiny particles that are often too small for you to see with the naked eye. And it's been said that it's likely that the virus spreads through both large respiratory droplets that we've heard about. So these are droplets that are usually large enough for you to actually see. So they're expelled when you cough or sneeze. In this case, probably cough, because COVID-19 generally doesn't cause people to sneeze. But these aerosols can be generated by nebulizers and the process of intubation. So people in the hospital should worry about this, because these medical devices that assist people in breathing can generate aerosols, which can contain the virus and potentially transmit it through the air. But it's now been shown anecdotally and in more formalized studies that it seems like there's a strong possibility that in everyday settings, aerosols are playing a significant role in the spread of COVID-19, but it's very unclear how large that role truly is. And that's a different question to answer. So from the start of the outbreak, we've heard a lot about these large respiratory droplets. And that's partially because in the world of respiratory infection, it's very easy to anecdotally observe when people cough, you can see a spray being emitted from their mouth. Now, in the context of speaking, breathing, singing, etc., you're also generating these aerosols. So this past week, I spoke to William Ristenpart, who is a professor at University of California, Davis, and he specifically studies aerosols in general in all their different forms, but also aerosols that specifically could potentially carry viral particles from person to person. And his lab recently did a study this past year that shows that the louder you speak, the more aerosols you are likely to generate. And then there's different, depending on the words you're speaking, certain words and the way your mouth forms the letters make it more likely that a higher percentage of aerosols will be generated by those sounds. So for instance, as an example, the E sound in the word need produces more aerosols than the ah sound in the word saw, as a very specific example. But what makes the real difference usually is simply the volume at which you're speaking. And then you also have a subset of people who, for currently unknown reasons, generate about 10 times more aerosols at baseline whenever they're talking or speaking, or speaking or breathing, rather. So in the context of COVID-19, when we learn more, it could be that super emitters also serve as super spreaders. But we really don't know the answer to those questions yet. But it would, if this were the case, it would help explain why people with little to no symptoms seem to drive the spread of the virus so much. So if you think about the number of people who could potentially be asymptomatic carrying around this virus, those people are not coughing on anyone. So how are they spreading the virus from person to person? How are they acting as a viral vector in this way? And if enough aerosols with a high enough viral load are being expelled from these people simply by they're holding conversations with random passerby, that could help to explain why this virus is so successful at spreading between people. Again, we need so much more data to really understand the role of speaking, singing, talking, breathing in this viral transmission. And in general, because we cannot observe the transmission process directly, a lot of those unknowns are difficult for us to get into because it's just difficult. There's no ethical study that you can do where you assemble a room of infected people and see how they can infect non-infected people. So those studies are that specific type of study would be the ideal to answer this question, and it's impossible to conduct. So scientists instead have to do a ton of detective work, which takes a long time. I'm going to start taking your questions now. Someone's asking me, aren't the tests for COVID-19 only testing for the symptoms? Are they forgetting about ignoring underlying illnesses? I think I understand what you're saying. So you're asking if people are only being tested if they're showing symptoms of COVID-19. Many of the symptoms of COVID-19 overlap with other illnesses caused by respiratory viruses. So the question becomes, how do we know we aren't forgetting about people who are also infected with other things or are alternatively infected with other things? So usually within, in the medical community, they call it differential diagnosis. And this is literally just the detective work that doctors do to figure out what a patient has. So typically, especially towards the start of this outbreak, people are tested for a number of different respiratory illnesses, including the flu, common cold. So they're given, generally speaking, multiple diagnostic tests that they're available at the time. And that is part of what is used to figure out if the person truly does have COVID-19. There have also been reports of people presenting with multiple illnesses at once. So just because you're infected with the common cold right now doesn't mean you're not also infected with COVID-19. That's not a tried and true fact. The exact number of people who present with comorbidities in this way is unclear at this point, but there has been data to show that they do exist, and there's a decent proportion of people who have multiple infections all at once, because at least here we're just coming out of flu season, really. So the peak of this virus happened to coincide with flu season pretty much step in step. So in that respect, certainly, especially early on, there were likely some cases missed because they were dismissed as something else. But now evidence would suggest that people are being tested for a lot of things, and COVID isn't just being swept aside as the least likely scenario. That said, if you are presenting with mild symptoms of any respiratory illness, it's unlikely still at this point that you'll be able to receive a test depending on where you live, because access to diagnostic testing still differs dramatically from city to city, especially here in the US. I'm getting a question about comparing COVID-19 to a flu or a cold. Can you differentiate these illnesses, please? Early on, we saw people fall down this slippery slope of comparing COVID-19 to the flu. My preference in differentiating the two is simply to describe COVID-19 as it is, because point blank, COVID-19 is not the flu. And the only through line that I can draw between them is that some symptoms overlap, not all symptoms, but some symptoms overlap, and they both happen to infect the respiratory tracts primarily. So they're primarily respiratory illnesses. There's a Venn diagram, there's large overlaps, but they're definitely distinct diseases. They're caused by totally different families of viruses. Colds have snuck in there because they're also a type of respiratory virus. And actually, 4 known coronaviruses cause the common cold in humans. So I think that's been thrown out as a comparison, because the 4 coronaviruses that cause the common cold in humans are distinct to coronaviruses that hopped from animals into humans, such as SARS, MERS, and now this new virus. So that's kind of the background for this. So just again, quickly, some of the top symptoms that are being reported for COVID-19 would be fever, a dry cough, meaning at least towards the beginning of the illness, a dry cough that's not, meaning it's not caused by a buildup of phlegm like it might be when you get a cold. It generally does not cause a stuffy nose. I won't say that universally, but generally speaking, it's not associated with a stuffy nose. There have been still fairly anecdotal reports of people losing their sense of smell and taste, at least towards the beginning of the illness. And there's a lot of work being done as to whether that's a prevalent symptom, whether that's truly common in a lot of people, and what that could mean for the course of illness. For more severe COVID-19 infections, once the disease progresses, it can become a pneumonia, meaning that the lungs become inflamed and begin to fill with pockets of pus, which of course makes it very difficult to transfer oxygen from the lungs throughout the body. Many people also report digestive issues, so constipation, diarrhea, nausea, these kind of symptoms. Some people have reported only presenting with those symptoms. These are fairly mild cases, but digestive issues could also be affiliated with COVID-19. And there are some hypotheses floating around that perhaps COVID-19 also infects the gastrointestinal tract directly to a lesser extent than the respiratory tracts. But again, those are still hypothetical scenarios. And you are, in very rare instances, seeing cognitive damage associated with COVID-19. So there was one woman who developed a fairly rare complication that's seen with other viral infections that caused her to have an altered mental state in addition to her fever and cough caused by COVID-19. So by other viral infections, I mean influenza as one of these infections that in certain people, if you're prone and other things run out of control, you can actually see kind of a heightened inflammatory response that causes organ damage in the brain. And again, this seems to be a very rare case in the context of COVID-19, but also in the context of all viral infections. It's a fairly rare occurrence for that to happen. Someone's asking, how long does someone have to be in your proximity outside before infection becomes a potential risk? So these are fairly open questions, unfortunately. First, I'll break down your question a little bit. So in your proximity, again, the current advice is to stay at least 6 feet away from people, given that respiratory droplets are of such a size that once expelled from the mouth, they fall to the ground within a few feet of a person, typically. That said, if someone has a fairly hearty cough and they don't cover their face in any way and they point it right at you, that doesn't mean that that droplet will stop traveling towards you at 6 feet exactly. So this is a fairly rule of thumb measurement that should especially be observed in enclosed spaces and poorly ventilated spaces. Given that we don't understand the role of aerosols in terms of the virus spread as of yet, aerosols can travel through the air and remain suspended in the air in a different way than respiratory droplets can. Respiratory droplets, because they're heavy, succumb to gravity, fall to the ground. These aerosols, depending on the airflow in the room or outside, depending on the heat and humidity of the space, there's many factors, but can actually be carried through the air on turbulent airflows and end up being dispersed more widely and remain suspended for up to hours in the air. Now, the questions remaining around that are, how much virus is actually contained in those aerosols? Is it a high enough quantity that we need to worry about that? Also, how many viral particles must a person inhale from that cloud of aerosols before they become infected? We don't know the answer to that question either. So this is all to say, the closer you are to a person, both inside and outside, raises your chance of transmission, point blank. That said, the longer you spend near a person, the higher your chances are of infection are going to get. Generally, best rule of thumb is to only interact with people from your own household to what extent you can, and those that you have to interact with beyond the household, if you can be wearing a mask, they can be wearing a mask of some sort, whatever you have available to you at this point, although N95 should really be conserved for healthcare workers. You maintain a fair bit of distance at bare minimum 6 feet. 10 feet is probably better measurement if you want to be a bit more careful, and you want to limit your time around those people, because the longer you're around them, the more viral particles are circulating in various ways, the higher chances of transmission. So I wish I could give you a better, more concrete number, but it really, there's so many variables, it's very difficult to give you a straight answer. I'm getting a question about animals who can be infected by SARS-CoV-2. So this week, we had a report of the first animal with a confirmed infection in the U.S., a tiger in the Bronx Zoo. So that's not necessarily surprising, but that made headline news this week. So there have been studies indicating that domestic cats, at least, can pick up the virus, and now it would appear that wild cats also can. Domestic cats, at least, have a very similar homolog of the ACE2 receptor in their respiratory tract as well. All that means is that their ACE2 receptor equivalent looks very similar to a human's. So that means that when the virus enters their bodies, they can develop symptoms that look akin to humans. So they do develop a dry cough and other things like that. And it appears that cats can pass the virus to each other and that they can pick it up from humans. But there's no evidence that cats can pass it back to humans. Of course, that will be a point of study going forward. There have been anecdotal cases of dogs catching the virus as well, and this was also true of the SARS virus that caused an outbreak in 2002 and 2003, so that's not really surprising. Other studies have suggested that ferrets can also catch the virus in a similar way to cats, but a number of typical farm yard kind of avian species of birds don't seem to pick up the virus. So that's the extent of what we know about. And then, of course, bats appear to be the origin point of a version of this virus. Kind of in that vein, there's been more data accumulating about the animals that might have passed this on to humans in the first place. So we think the origin point was in bats. And now evidence suggests that coronaviruses seen in bats don't bond very well to their equivalent of the ACE2 receptor, but there's some sort of chemical structural change that has occurred that actually means that this new virus bonds very snugly into human cells. So this conformational change has taken place in the spike protein, which the virus sticks into cells to infect them. So there is a what they're calling a ridge, this compact structure that's seen in this the human SARS-CoV-2 virus, the one that affects humans rather, that means that it bonds with our cells really tightly and easily. And in bats, it doesn't do the same, or when it, related coronaviruses wouldn't appear to do the same. We still don't know what that intermediate animal is, but within the next week, there will be more data to share on that front. Getting question, do we know how many people appear to be entirely asymptomatic, meaning they do not develop symptoms, at least at first? There have been some evidence that people who were initially clocked as asymptomatic later develop some sort of symptoms. The proportion of those people is unclear. But there was a study out of China that looked at about 370, 375 cities in China to try to answer this question. And these researchers developed a mathematical model to try to estimate how many people likely were asymptomatic through time as the outbreak progressed. So they estimated that for every person who tested positive for the coronavirus in China, there were likely 5 to 8 asymptomatic people who didn't know that they had the infection. Again, this is a mathematical model. Think of it not necessarily as you do a weather forecast, but it's based on our understanding of the virus at present and our understanding of its spread at present. And it's sort of an estimate, a forecast based on data that we have to hand. So this may or may not be the exact picture of what truly happened, but at least at face value, take that to mean that many, many more people appear to have been asymptomatic as compared to the positive cases that we caught, especially early on in the outbreak, because those who present to a healthcare setting are more likely to have a severe disease. Is part of that bias and why we're not going to catch asymptomatic people. But also, if you think you're well, you'll go about your daily life as normal and you would never suspect that you have the virus. If you don't cough, can you still have COVID-19? Yes. So not everyone develops a cough, kind of in line with the asymptomatic discussion. So if people aren't presenting with symptoms, they would not have a cough. Beyond that, some people, like I said, seem to only present with digestive symptoms and don't develop a cough. Some people, on the other hand, progress to a full-fledged pneumonia. And when you have a pneumonia or acute respiratory syndrome, wherein again, the lungs fill with some sort of a pus liquid, what the body is trying to do when it generates that mucus is it wants to gather up all the pathogens that are present and get them out of you. So the sticky fluid that builds up is a way to do that. Think about when stuff gets into your nose, there's an easy exit point where you already have mucus present at that site and all the debris that gathers in your nose can easily be sent out back into the world and out of your body. Now, down in the lungs, obviously there's not an easy exit. So you have this really deep hacking cough that develops because the body needs to work so much harder to try to get that out of you. And in a hospital setting with really severe pneumonia, the healthcare workers will help to drain that fluid manually as part of the course of treatment. I'm getting a follow-up question about why the HWO is not currently considering loss of smell as an official symptom of COVID-19. Given that the reports on smell loss and taste loss have, again, been very anecdotal, meaning that while we're getting reports from both patients with COVID-19 and the doctors treating them that people are showing this symptom, it has not been systematically studied. So we don't have a number we can give you as to the percentage of patients that truly present with the symptom. And given all the other diseases that are circulating this time of year, there's many reasons why people might temporarily lose their sense of smell. Also, smell loss is incredibly common, especially in elderly populations. That's a normal sign of aging, is that your sense of smell begins to be diminished. So the HWO doesn't want to raise a red flag that isn't a real red flag, because then everyone with loss of smell, and again, this is a higher percentage of people than most people realize, may begin number one, panicking, but presenting to clinics thinking they need to be tested for COVID-19 right now, which is not necessarily the case. So until they have better data to share with you, they probably won't confirm that as an official symptom. And that data is being collected as we speak. I've spoken to some of the people who are conducting these studies, and they're well underway. I have a question about reports that talk about the amount or dose of a virus and how that relates to disease severity. And also, as a tie into that, how the virus is actually being transmitted to these people, i.e. through the eyes, nose, mouth, whether that makes a difference. So generally speaking, the dose of a virus, any virus, affects your chances of becoming infected and often affects the severity of disease. What we don't know about this virus is where those thresholds lie. So what is considered a low dose of the virus, what is considered a moderate dose of the virus, and what is considered a high dose of the virus. And we, within different subpopulations of people, it's likely that some people have a far lower threshold for both infection and severe disease, meaning that even if they're only exposed to a low dose of the virus, they inherently may have a higher chance of picking it up and developing a pneumonia. Whereas other people exposed to a moderate dose of the virus might not have such a severe reaction. So all those questions are still floating around. That said, this is especially an important question for healthcare workers, and especially within the SARS epidemic of 2002-2003, but other epidemics as well, healthcare workers are in the line of fire in this way. And without proper protective equipment, they stand to ingest higher doses of the virus than probably anyone else, which is why, especially early on in China, you were getting all these reports of healthcare workers falling terribly ill and dying. And that's why protective equipment is so incredibly important for people treating those with COVID-19. The bleak picture of where we're at in the United States is that there's not enough protective equipment to go around. It's not being distributed in such a way that every healthcare worker has access to the protective equipment they really need to mitigate the dose of the virus that they are inhaling and interacting with. This places them at extreme risk. So keeping that in mind, we don't know exactly what those numbers are in terms of what constitutes a high dose of the virus. And in terms of the method by which it's introduced, I don't think there have been studies that, again, we don't observe the transmission process directly. So we know that viruses can enter the body via aerosols inhaled, and these aerosols, because they're so small, can get deeper into the lungs than respiratory droplets. They can be picked up as respiratory droplets, fomites, off of surfaces. Also, aerosols settle eventually, and they can also be picked up onto your hands. And if they're deposited onto some sort of membranous tissue, such as that found in your eyes, nose, mouth, this can cause an infection. And then just having close contact with someone who's infected opens you up to the risk of infection as well. So we know these routes exist. We do not know which route is the primary route that this virus uses to spread. And we don't know if one route is affiliated with more severe disease. So these are all good questions, but we don't have good answers at this moment. I'm going to pick one more question. We have a ton this week, and we'll go through and be copying and pasting links to some of our articles that address these questions in the comments below. But also, many of these questions are at least addressed on livescience.com if you want to check them out yourself and read more deeply into what I've talked about today. And you can always pose these questions on our forums, forums.livescience.com. I'll close on this one because this seems like an important point. Someone is asking if something resembling soap can be developed that would be sprayed into the mouth or throat that could kill the virus before it enters the lungs. So part of why soap is great for killing viruses is that it breaks down the fatty membrane that encases the virus. In this case, soap doesn't universally kill viruses as effectively as it does coronaviruses. For instance, noroviruses are particularly difficult to kill, but because coronaviruses are enveloped in this fatty membrane, they are vulnerable to attack by soap. That said, ingesting anything that's like soap, putting it into your body, is not good for your health. And I understand the idea of killing the virus on contact, disinfecting your body as you would a surface, is an interesting idea, certainly. And people have played with that in terms of trying to experiment with UV radiation, because it's shown that viruses universally don't like to be exposed to high levels of UV because it dries them out and they are unable to survive in those conditions. So people are also looking at things like that in terms of a disinfectant that could be easily applied. The best mode of killing a virus within the body is an antiviral of some sort, because that is designed to be metabolized by the body, is the goal, with limited side effects, which is why antivirals take a while to develop. But ingesting something like soap really isn't an option. And if you are spraying something into your mouth or throat, in effect, you are ingesting it, because it will get into your body from there. On that note, I think I'll wrap up for the day. Thank you again for tuning in, and we'll be doing this again next week and foreseeable future, most likely. Again, check out the written articles on livescience.com if you have further questions. Many of them, if you search the question and live science, will pop up as one of our articles and you can explore further.
Thanks for joining us for this special coronavirus report from Life's Little Mysteries with Live Science. You can find all the Live Science coverage of the coronavirus and COVID-19 on our website at livescience.com/topics/coronavirus.
We'll be refreshing our FAQ and coronavirus updates daily as information becomes available. The link is in the show notes.
If you have questions about coronavirus or COVID-19, you can post them on our Live Science forums and on Facebook.
Thanks for joining us, and stay healthy.
Life's Little Mysteries is produced in conjunction with Audio Boom as part of their Audio Boom Originals Network.